Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a Retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, on episode 410, we preview the November 2023 edition of Retinal Physician. As a reminder, Retinal Physician is published online and in print and is available for free online at retinalphysician.com. This issue focuses on pediatric retina, so I brought on two of my favorite pediatric retina specialists, Dr. Safa Rahmani and Yoshio Nakama, to discuss these articles. We talk about the assessment of pediatric retinal detachments, updates to retinopathy of prematurity, guidelines and classification, and then we move on to non-pediatric retina topics, including a discussion of wide-field imaging for diabetic retinopathy, and an observation made of the use of drops for ptosis association with vitreo macular traction. Remember, a list of relevant financial disclosures are always found in the episode description.
Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now back with a preview of the November 2023 edition of Retinal Physician. We're recording in this in advance of the American Academy of Ophthalmology meeting, although this episode will come out after. So forgive us if we don't say anything super cool that happened at the meeting. Joining us for this episode, two of my colleagues from around the country, Dr. Safa Rahmani, who's in Chicago. Safa, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me, Jay.
And Dr. Yoshio Nakama in Philadelphia.
Awesome to be back. Thank you.
So I brought on, I can't say my two favorite because I'm going to insult someone, but two of my favorite pediatric retina specialists to talk about this edition, because the focus of this edition was pediatric retina, although we have some things that are not pediatric retina. So the first article we're going to talk about, and remember, these articles are available for free online at retinalphysician.com, was Clinical Pearls for Pediatric Retinal Detachment. This was written by a team of doctors with senior author Nicholas Yanuzzi here from Baska-Palmer. And so, again, you can read the article to get most, but I would say big take-homes from this article, they go through the etiology and risk factors. I think the big things is, again, to think about some sort of trauma, even if there's no clear history, but also think about genetic sort of syndromes and ask very careful family histories in these instances. I think that it's important to think about non-accidental trauma, especially in the setting of abuse from a socioeconomic perspective. I think that one of the big things is sort of determining how to assess these patients. And then they really go into, besides the tools used to image these patients, they go into surgical management. And one of the things that I think big take home here is these patients are, I'll quote Yoshi, he always says, pediatric eyes are not little adult eyes. These patients have a different prognosis. You know, the prognosis of pediatric RDs, because of delayed presentation, because of macular involvement, and probably because of the hyoid status, is very different than adult RDs. And they go through all the different options, ranging from laser all the way to vitrectomy or buccal vitrectomy. I think that one of the big points that they make is that patients who are candidates for vitrectomy do tend to have complex, because of the complex RDs, they do tend to do better with a buccal vitrectomy versus just a vitrectomy, which I think for you two is very obvious. I think we've all spoken about the importance of buccaling in these patients, but this is an issue that comes up because there are people out in practice who still sometimes will go for straight vitrectomy in these patients. And then the other thing is they talk about the bilateral issue. And so definitely consider fellow eye exam, consider fellow eye prophylaxis, depending on the genetic syndrome. How do you perform that in terms of anesthesia? It may be worth doing a good exam under anesthesia when you do this. And then, of course, thinking about self-injurious behavior, especially if this is a pediatric patient who has got some sort of mental disability or other syndrome. So, Safa, I'll let you kick it off. I thought this was a really good review. I think this is, if I was operating on a kid and I was out in practice and I was forced to operate on the kid in the scenario, I'd probably read this really carefully just to pick up some pearls. I think probably the biggest pearl is the pearl about buckling. But just from an assessment standpoint, it can be really hard to examine these patients. So, like, do you have age cutoffs past which, like how, I feel like some kids are really good. You can sit them in an optos and get a decent picture. Some kids, how aggressively does your team try? Like, how, what's the youngest patient you've captured like a reasonable optos in the clinic on?
At 2.5 is the youngest that I've been able to do. And I think it really kind of what you mentioned, it really comes down to the team. You know, when you are, when your team knows how to deal with kids and sort of when to stagger, like maybe not dilate, maybe try to take a picture because they're coming in with a concern, you know, with optos, even if you get, you know, three pictures, you may get more out of those optos pictures than an actual exam in a toddler, which can really change your, you know, sort of management in terms of, okay, next step is going to be exam on anesthesia or, you know, whatever it may be. So I think having a team that is comfortable with kids is really can really drive how low of an age group you can go in terms of getting pictures and imaging and exam. And then I have all the residents kind of rotate with me and sort of focusing on things that will give you the most bang for your buck when you're trying to examine is really key because, you know, residents are used to going, you know, like we're going to start with the slit lamp and go to this and this and this. And I think really honing in like, okay, what do I really need to get? The child's fussy or not? We've got treats and all sorts of things in the peds hospital to kind of try to see, okay, can we get a look? Can we, and what can we get out and what will be the next step? So I think those are all really helpful things for, especially for people who are, you know, don't really see kids as often. I think not pigeonholing them into trying to do what you would do with an adult patient, because you only want to, you want to grab the most helpful parts of the exam when you have the chance. And that may be completely out of the order that you would do, which a lot of times I'll start with imaging first before I even dilate them. So those are things. And I think this paper really, and I'm sure Yoshi will talk about this as well, the really the art of buckling and really how I really encourage all trainees in vitreoretinal surgery to know how to buckle at least decently well. Because PEDS cases, you really can't go wrong with a buckle, even if it's a staged approach where you kind of throw a buckle. Sometimes it works wonders, even if you're not sure, and kind of come back and save the vitrectomy for another day because of everything that you mentioned and it mentions in the article in terms of all the issues that can come from vitrectomy.
Yoshi, that's a really, really thorough discussion. I don't know if it's possible for you to add anything. I'm sure you're going to find something on the bone that you can pick off of. I mean, anything else you would add about pediatric detachments?
Yeah, you know, during the assessment, I think, you know, Safa's really spot on with the wide field imaging is really nice and the focused exam and a few other kind of practical pearls that I've kind of, you know, learned along the way has been first looking at the red reflex. We don't really even bother with adults, but just like initially looking at the red reflex, if there's something going on like supratemporal, and if you know, the red reflex turns yellowish over there, you know, that's where you want to look. And so then you hone in, you do all of this with your indirect light very relatively low. And I try to do the exam without touching the child. And so just hovering the lens in front of the face with a low light is a good way to do it. Another tool that's really helpful is the B scan and ultrasonography. Kids will tolerate a lot more than ophthalmoscopy.
Yeah, I think that, again, I haven't had to do many of these, thankfully, because people like you two exist who take care of the bulk of them. I think Yoshi is reiterating something you've said before and you guys both mentioned. I just think that it's probably worth, if you don't know anything, just throw a buckle on to start and then you can always reassess. Like, especially let's say in your scenario where your pediatric retina specialist isn't available for a few weeks or they're out of town and you have to want to do something, you could wait, but also you could just buckle them. You don't have to go crazy with your cryo. You don't have to go crazy with training. Just try to put a buckle on. It's not going to hurt anything for a future surgery. Quickly, bands. Do you guys have preferences for bands in kids from a buckle perspective that are different than adults? I've heard of some people like to put a 42 on a kid versus 41, 40, 50s, wider bands. Do you have any differences, Yoshi, in terms of how you buckle?
Exactly as you said. I don't think it really matters, but I prefer to do 42s for kids. And I usually don't for adults. I'll do a 41 usually. I'll use radial elements more often in children also. But just to give the listeners just an FYI, give Jay more credit. Jay takes care of a lot of children also. And you are plenty a pediatric retina surgeon.
Oh, man. Please don't say that. Not loudly, at least.
I agree. Oh, man. I agree with Yoshi as well. I tend to use the 40-50 if it's a straight buckle. Just that extra millimeter makes me feel better. But it's really where you place it. I don't think I've ever regretted placing a buckle. I've always regretted not putting a buckle, whether it's concurrent or before and things like that. So I think really placing it is key and it's very helpful. So, and it's I don't want it to be a lost art. So I think it's really important to have that skill. And as you said, even if you know that this is not going to be your patient, but it happens to be your patient because it's a, you know, retinal dialysis. You know, I've had community docs throw in a buckle, no cryo, no nothing, and then send the patient to me because they knew that, you know, that patient with a retinal dialysis really needs a buckle, but they were not comfortable taking care of the rest of it. So even in that scenario, I prefer a buckle. Just send it after. It's absolutely fine. But I've had that happen as well, where, you know, we have some of the community surgeons who just don't do, like, they'll do buckle once every 10 years, you know, but when the need arises, you really want to be able to do it. And then you can send it to your friendly pediatric retina specialist, but put that buckle on.
You know, your comment about the, just the buckle on without cryo, I think that still works. You don't have to do cryo. For example, if you have an eye with vitreous hemorrhage, you can't really find the breaks. Usually in adults, that's an indication for a vit or a buccal vit. But in kids, you could just put that buckle on. A lot of times it's going to work. It's going to reattach. And when the heme clears, you can, you know, retinopexy later.
Let's move on to ROP, because I'm glad I don't take care of ROP and you guys do. It's keeping up with ICROP. This is changes to retinopathy of premature declassification impact practice. Brittany Scruggs with a senior author here. And the ICROP is International Classification of Retinopathy of Prematurity. They just discussed the guidelines that have shifted in 2021. And so I could review, I think the big take homes are some small changes here based on the zones, the stages, and plus disease. And then there's some updated guidelines about what happens afterwards. So I think the original guidelines, a lot of discussion was just about the presentation and then how you manage it. But it makes sense at some point to start talking about, especially with anti-VEGF now available, what happens later? Like, what? How do you classify? How do you treat? I'm almost scared to think about what is the most important thing here, because I don't know if I have the context for it. Like, so Safa, if you had to like tell somebody, I graduated residency and fellowship a while ago, like, what's kind of the biggest take-home change? Like, is there anything that has changed in your practice, or is this sort of just reflecting the patterns that people are already doing?
That's a good point. So I think the most important shift that at least needs to be on everyone's mind is the fact that we now have, you know, ubiquitous use of anti-VEGF and what that will do long-term for all the findings that we have with the anti-VEGF era is really a point of discussion. And we still don't know a lot of, you know, what is too much avascular retina, what is too little, when do you treat, when do you not treat, the reactivation, you know, in terms of all these new anti-VEGF options are quite a bit in terms of for the discussion of how low do you go, what agent you use, all those, I think, is really the most important aspect of this revamp from 2021. I don't think the anatomical aspects, I think it's really important still, but it doesn't change significantly in terms of the management.
Yoshi, anything to add?
Yeah, I think there's nothing like revolutionary about this update, but new concepts are discussed. And I think in our field, the hottest topic that's part of the new eye drop is PAR, that's P-A-R, persistent avascular retina, that Safa was alluding to. And a lot of babies, especially after anti-VEGF treatment, have residual avascular retina. And right now, we're trying to figure out what to do with that. And some people like Eric Neuleman are doing great work showing that the higher the stage of the disease, the more likely you're going to have PAR. You know, a lot of people may just leave PAR alone. Personally, I laser everything. So if I do an anti-VEGF injection, I'm going to do a laser before the baby's discharged. Because long-term, we've shown that you can get a lot of complications from that avascular retina, like regmatogenous detachments, as you know, the kids get a little older.
I'm with Yoshi as well. I, you know, our plan whenever a child gets anti-VEGF is to plan a scheduled laser once they're above 6 months old for just assessment of that avascular retina, and I laser everything as well because I think the risk benefit is quite large in terms of not doing something and potentially saving an eye, because they're going to show up when they're teenagers and older children. So the same issues that we're talking about with the previous article applies. It's going to be a very complex detachment to potentially fix, and the laser risk is so incredibly low once they're older. Anesthesia risk is much, much less. I just think you win on all arounds if you treat that avascular retina, but maybe it'll be different in 20 years.
And also after anti-VEGF, the recurrence rate is so high. a lot of people in the beginning, the BEAT ROP study said that it was one and done. You have just have to inject once, but we quickly found out that's not the case. And recurrence is very, very common. But with laser, you know, you do a laser and then you're okay. Recurrence is after that, very, very rare. Unless you're like one of the babies I'm taking care of now who were born like really, really early and keep on recurring. There can be some challenges, but usually laser, you're done. And even if there are lots to follow up, oftentimes they're okay. And that's also a major issue. You know, the kids have a hard time following up. That's a major problem. And these kids have a lot of comorbidities and they have so many medical appointments that we really have to stay on top of their follow-up.
So let's go to an article that one of you, I won't say who, said, that's weird when I sent it to it, and it wasn't Sapa. It's called Vitreoretinal Adverse Effects Associated with Oxymethylxylene Drops for Blepharoptosis. Alpha agonists may play a prior role in vitreoretinal traction. This is by Jessica Barrest and Alan Dayan. And again, quick recap, they talk about these alpha agonists. So if you haven't been paying attention, people have started, there is Upneeq, which is essentially a non-selective alpha agonist that activates Mueller's muscle, gives you about 2 millimeter elevation of your lid, has been approved as a cosmetic treatment for transient relief of blepharoptosis, an option besides surgery, essentially. They have a case that they showed here that they think that there may be vitreoretinal effects from this drug, because it not only will induce this, you know, elevation of the lid, it may actually also cause issues with meiosis. And they have a patient who they gave the drop, and then within basically 2 days of starting the drop, started developing floaters, was found to have a horseshoe tear that was treated in a PVD. Patient also had vitreoretinal traction, ERM, no other history. There was a big discussion about this relative to drops in the past, you know, pilocarpine acuity. There were some papers published about this. Oxymethylxylene or Upneeq, little less data out there in terms of this happening. But again, it's an interesting discussion. Again, drops that may seem innocuous, perhaps in patients who are higher risk or perhaps in patients who fit a certain profile, may have side effects. I'm a little curious what you think about this, Yoshi. You know, I do think the pilocarpine data, I think, is compelling. I think that there was data for back in the day when it was used for glaucoma, and there have been reports of patients developing issues with intraocular traction, PVD, retinal detachment, retinal tear with that. What do you think about Upneeq, oxymethylxylene? You know, I don't really think about brimonidine, for example. They say it's very similar chemically to brimonidine. I don't really think of brimonidine as a risk, you know, for these patients, but maybe, again, that's showing my narrow view. There's probably some patients it's a risk for. What do you think about this in terms of risk profile?
Yeah, so, well, that's kind of weird, was my initial reaction before I actually read the article. But when you read it, the authors do a great job kind of, you know, talking about potential mechanisms and stuff. And I think it's compelling. You know, they talk about how the meiosis may be the cause where when eyes get meiotic, you have the anterior movement of the lens, which may cause traction. And, you know, the pilocarpine data, it's actually just a bunch of case reports. And each case report's kind of compelling, but there's no like hard evidence for it. And so we don't really know yet. And so I think, you know, the case reports are kind of compelling. I am sure this is rare, and some people may be more prone to developing vitreoretinal traction from the lens diaphragm kind of moving. And so I feel like, I don't know, it's something we should definitely talk about, but we need better evidence. I just kind of felt that, you know, recently we have so many of these really old medications that we've been using for like decades and decades being repackaged, repurposed, and being sold for like hundreds of dollars, which is just kind of, that's really weird. You know, like VOD, that's pilocarpine. You have Latisse, that's a prostaglandin analog. Lumify is brimonidine. And this Upneeq is just Visine and Afrin.
Yeah, it's everyone loves a rerun, Yoshi.
Yeah.
You know, Fuller House, Cobra Kai, Upneeq. You know, there's no new ideas.
Yeah, we can probably repackage Betadine, and let's think of something for it.
Safa, what do you think?
No, I think what I had a hard time with this particular paper was, why couldn't this particular scenario, why couldn't it have just all been a spontaneous PVD that happened to have started, you know, the causation versus the whether this is actually happening. And the other thing was, you know, with brimonidine, like, is there a way to, you know, look into the IRIS registry or some of these big databases that people who are on brimonidine have a higher risk of detachments and various other things? I'd never heard of that, but if it's the same, if it's the meiosis mechanism, and we know that that happens in brimonidine, why don't we, you know, there's so there are millions of patients on brimonidine for glaucoma. So I think that would be something to look into, you know, and from a systems base, could that show something? But I had a hard time, you know, sort of saying this is just
causation. And there were, the thing is, there was like trials of brimonidine implant, remember? Not drops, but and I don't remember a higher incidence of RD in the treatment group. And that was a smaller trial. Maybe the numbers are small, but it's just like one of those correlation causation things, right? It's like this thing happened, but there is a certain percentage of people who do have PVDs and tears. So it's like, you need to really, like you said, Safa, line them up side by side and see, okay, is this rhythm? It's interesting. Last article, I'll just go quickly. And again, I saved it for last, not because it's not interesting, but because we have spent a lot of time talking about this very hot topic in our field, which is detection of peripheral retinal non-perfusion in diabetic patients using ultra-wide-field imaging by Ali Ergene. This is basically a description of my life at a county hospital. And again, quick recap, he goes through ultra-wide-field imaging. I think the most popular system that people talk about is the Optos, and people sort of use Optos interchangeably with ultra wide field imaging, but there are other options. Optos is kind of the most ubiquitous. It's kind of the Google of search engines, is Optos ultra wide field fundus photos right now. And they show, you know, some case presentation of basically how grading is sometimes limited when you grade someone in the clinic. But if you get color photos outside of the ETDRS7 fields, then you can sort of see a lot more pathology. And then they show, of course, the FA that corresponds. Safa, I think we've talked about this quite a bit. I think most of us are trying to incorporate it into our practice. I think FAs are exceptionally helpful, but even just the images are really, really helpful. I mean, I think the hard thing, I think the thing that's the question is, do you really need a person to examine these patients, right? I think this has been discussed from a teleretinal standpoint, but how many people out there are better than an Optos photo in terms of capturing, or do you just need people to read images? And last time we did this podcast, I had Ajay and Lediana on, we were talking about automated screening, and Ajay brought up the point that the technology is there, it's just, it's not financially incentivized. That's why it hasn't sort of been streamlined where people are getting, you know, ultra-wide field images, automated readings, II, all of this. It's very different in terms of what you can do versus what is financially viable for a company. But it seems like, again, I feel a little bad because I think that our skills are still important. I think depression skills are really, really important. But you can make some argument that with good media, an Optos photo is probably better than 99.9% of us at just looking at the retina for, let's say, diabetic retinopathy.
No, that's a good, it's a good point. I don't disagree that, you know, Optos can give you so much more information. I do think there's still something to be said about looking in, because especially with Optos that I'm most familiar with, there's a lot of artifacts when you get to the periphery. So there, you can easily miss things. I think a case can be made for the Optos FA that has a lot less artifact. I think if you bring in a wide field angiogram, then you can really make a case, at least with Optos, because the quality is better and the artifacts are much less. Like, could you build a whole paradigm around that? In terms of screening for patients. And, you know, in my practice, it's routine that the first diabetics that I, you know, that come to my clinic, they'll get an ultra wide FA and Optos. And I'm still continuously surprised based on what I see in my exam, what I thought I would see on FA. And I think there's a lot, you know, especially with the type 1 diabetics that have a few microaneurysms, and all of a sudden you get a wide field FA and this massive, massive non-perfusion. So I think there's something to be said about the FA part, but I think I get enough of the Optos artifacts from outside optometrists who are like, oh, there's a tear, there's a lesion or a detachment, or there's so much artifact that I'm not sure that it's ready for prime time AI use unless we teach it how to decipher artifact. I think that's a little bit more nuanced thing that our field is still very good at, separating artifact from real life. So I think those are parts that definitely could affect this. But I mean, you know, from a systems health point of view, if someone has no access to a retinal specialist, you know, where does it lie in terms of, you know, having AI help and bringing them in? So
Yoshi, I had a resident ask me the other day, they said, it's funny, I think you have different contexts as a resident. You're trying to make decisions about your careers. And they're like, you know, I'm not sure. I want to be a retina specialist. The injections are all getting longer and longer and going to be done by PAs. The exams are going to be done by AI and fundus photos. And the surgeries are all going to be done by robots led by Dr. Hubschman out in UCLA. So what's going to be left for me as a retinal surgeon? Of course, I talked them off the ledge, but to the point about the exam skills and scope, you know, I think there's wide availability of optos at the optometry level, right? Or at the conference of ophthalmology level, maybe even percentage-wise wider than retina practices in some area, because you can charge cash pay in those instances for the optos. Obviously, there are artifacts. There are things that are picked up that are not. It's always good to have more information. But I do think, and I've seen cases where the retina exam has either been delayed, deferred, or sort of punted because of the optos. And that can be good or that can be bad. Anything based on your experience, you're at a big referral retina practice. I'm sure you see a ton of optos photos from referring doctors texted to your phone, WhatsApp to your phone, or just patient comes in with a printout of one, which is most useless. Like, what are you, it's good. I just think, how do you think it's best harnessed and from a referring doctor standpoint?
Yeah, you know, the faxed optos images are terrible, as you mentioned. And when I was a fellow, I kind of looked it up because there's a way to look up at the time on the optos website, like which practices have optoses. And there were definitely more optometrists who had optos cameras than ophthalmologists and even retina doctors at the time. I'm sure that's probably changed in the past 7-8 years. But I think it's overall still a good thing that optometrists can catch things earlier, and the hit rate may be lower than, you know, us evaluating optos images, but I feel like our referrals have increased for diabetic retinopathy, and that's a good thing. And I think that, you know, increasing access, obviously very important, and how it's going to be delivered in the future, it's going to be in primary care doctor offices, right? But the socioeconomics of it, I think it still needs to be worked on. Getting back to more of the retina side of things, I agree with Safa that the fluorescein, wide field fluorescein, is kind of like the main reason that I think retina doctors would want to have wide field imaging, but I don't think you need it on every single patient. And we have it in most of our offices, but for example, I go to one clinic where we don't have it, and I still manage the patients pretty okay, I think. And if I'm unsure about something, I'll have the patients go to an office where we have wide field fluorescein. And because we're a practice that's been around for a long time, we see a lot of patients. We've also had a lot of, not a lot, but we've encountered complications of fluorescein too. And so it's not without risks. And my hope is that wide field OCT angiography will become cheaper and more accessible and not cost hundreds of thousands of dollars in the future. And I read I saw a very, very interesting article just this morning in Ophthalmology Science, where I think it was a group from Hong Kong, I believe, they used color images and used artificial intelligence to make them into fluorescence. And it trained that algorithm to make, you know, fluorescence with leakage and everything just based on color photos. I thought that was pretty cool. And that was more of a feasibility study, so it's not validated, but that might be the future.
Yeah. Well, it's always great to have two of my favorite, if not my two favorite, pediatric retina specialists join me. I'm hoping no one heard the part, or Louis, if you can cut the part out where they said I was a pediatric retina specialist too, I'd really appreciate it. Yoshi and Safa, thanks so much for your time. Hopefully you have a great academy meeting for those of you going. And thanks for taking care of those little kids' eyes so the rest of us don't have to usually.
Always a lot of fun, Jay. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks again to Drs. Ramani and Onakamba for joining us for this episode. Remember, you can find all 410 episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. They are listed by categories and sorted. Again, I just recently had a reader write in saying that he needed CME credits, and he went and binged about 40 of those episodes to get his credits. Remember, the older episodes, we got CME credits through the Academy. So if you're ever short on credits and if you haven't claimed those and you're an AAO member, not a bad idea. I was telling my wife, I can't think of anything more painful than listening to my voice for 40 episodes with like 20 hours of content. But if you do enjoy learning, I try to minimize how much I talk relative to our guests. You can always do that for CME credit. Remember, we are in the Apple and Android podcast section on your mobile device and also on Twitter at Retina Podcast. Reach out anytime with feedback, retinapodcast@gmail.com, or by clicking on the contact us link on our website. Thanks to our whole production team, Drs. Justin Ma, Louis Kai, Mike Benacasa, Angela Chen. This is Jay Schreeder signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.